This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this, a brand new episode of the Film Pastor Podcast, the sister podcast to the Lambcast, which can be found at largeassmovieblogs.com. Actually, I like to think of our show as the kind of like bastard stepchild of the Lambcast because we never show up as often as we would like to. Anyways, I am the Vern, and with me, hopefully, as always, is the wonderful, lovely, beautiful co-host, Kristen Lopez of Journeys in Classic Film. Hello, Kristen.
Hello, everybody.
Am I wrong in saying that we're kind of the bastard stepchild of the Lambcast because we don't show up as often as we like to, and when we do, it's just to collect money?
Sure.
and nothing else. We just go there to parties and we eat all the food and,
We get paid by DC or Marvel to write good or bad reviews.
I don't get shit. I got
neither,
nothing.
Neither do I. That's the most hilarious thing I've ever heard.
Well, joining us for this episode today is the wonderful gentleman from Exploding Helicopters, both the site and the podcast, Mr. Will Slater. Hello, Will.
Hi there, thanks for having me on, and I like to see the Film Pasture as the sort of part of the Lambcast cinematic universe, really.
Oh, but hopefully the good version, right? Like, not the bad, you know, not like the Incredible Hulk or Iron Man 2, I hope, right?
It's the Man of Steel of the Lambcast podcast.
The Man of Steel, yeah. So we're not quite the Batman v Superman of the Lambcast.
Or Superman Returns, not quite that bad.
Not that bad. Wait, Superman Returns has some good stuff in there, all right?
They had a fax machine.
You're not agreeing with me on this one, all right? Kevin Spacey, he was good in that.
If you say so.
That's the only thing I can remember from that movie. But anyways, folks, we're here today to talk about critics. And that they don't know shit. Now, basically, there's been a lot of like debates between audiences and critics. Critics would give movies, you know, bad reviews. They end up doing very well, and audiences are saying that we don't know anything. They don't know anything about movies and whatnot there too. And looking at the most recent box office right here, few movies here have, you know, gotten some critical praises, but most of the time that's not the case. And I'm going to start off with you here, Kristen, because you here are the only one that is an actual paid critic. Which is, you know, paid rate for movies.
Paid is a relative term. It really depends on the outlet. I have been paid to write reviews.
Exactly. See, you know.
Whether it's consistent is up for debate.
All right. But do you think that there, I'm just going to start with you because you're the most kind of prolific one here for all the different shows and podcasts and all the different sites you write for. Do you think that there's a kind of this wage battle between audiences and critics or not?
I think people are very confused in this day and age because literally the quote, everybody is a critic, is very true in this day and age on the internet. You can write about movies anywhere. So I think people get very confused about what makes a critic, as in somebody who has not necessarily a degree in film or has essentially writing ability and or gets paid for their opinion, and everybody else that just decides to start a blog and write about movies. And those are two very distinct halves because I think critics, professional critics, get lumped in with them. And you hear celebrities now say, oh, you know, this film isn't for the critics. Most people that get into criticism do it because they love it. I mean, if we didn't like movies in some capacity, we wouldn't spend our time because 98% of critics will tell you there's no money in it. So we're not getting paid. why do we do a job that we don't get paid for that causes people to berate us endlessly? Well, because we like movies. So I always get offended when people say, you know, oh, it's not for the critics. Well, critics are people that just happen to fall into doing something that they love and are good at. You know, it's, we don't go into, I know I don't go into a movie expecting it to be horrible, or else I wouldn't waste my time.
But being as a critic too, you also have a chance to see, now from the stage you rate for, you do have to see even movies you don't want to see and try to give them an honest review. And that can be somewhat difficult too, especially if you're not expecting it to be good or not. Like, I went to, you know, start off here, I went into Batman v Superman with pretty high expectations. The trailer looked good, and I ignored all critical reviews of the movie until after I saw it. And just watching it from strictly a fan base, I was disappointed because they added too many plot lines and too many stories in there. I'm not going to go into a review of that. If you want to listen to the review of Batman v Superman, please listen to the Lambcast episode on that. They go into really great discussion of that. Basically, the whole thing about having to write for something and being a fan. Because, yeah, that's true. I mean, you can basically be a fan and just kind of tweet something about a movie and call yourself a critic. I think of a critic as a person that, you know, is adamant on different sites or writes for different sites and, you know, is connected with other film people, other film bloggers or podcasters. That, to me, is a critic. But a real professional one is one that writes for, you know, a really well-known newspaper or things like that. I don't know. What's your take on this?
Well, I slightly disagree with that. I think for me, the sort of the key elements of a critic is that they are somebody who, you know, perhaps understands some of the technical natures of making a film. So they understand, you know, what the different shots are, perhaps what sort of story structure kind of classically many films operate by. I think for me, a film critic is somebody who needs to have a broad knowledge of film and somebody who strives to understand the context in which perhaps a filmmaker or an actor is working. And it is somebody who approaches a film with the aim of being analytical and, you know, rather than just describing a film, you know, and giving a subjective opinion on it. So, you know, I think it's, you know, I wouldn't personally describe myself as a critic. I'm just somebody who reviews films, you know, and I largely just make sarcastic jokes about them. You know, I would never label myself as a film critic, but I really do value film critics. And I do think that we, you know, I think it's important in this discussion to kind of define terms here, because, you know, the democratizing effect of the website, of the internet, I think has made understanding what a film critic, who a film critic is and who isn't a film critic, much more difficult. And whilst I think everyone is entitled to an opinion, I'm afraid I come at this from a rather conservative opinion, in the sense that I think there are some opinion, you know, not all opinions are equal. And I think that, you know, somebody who is, I'd rather, you know, trust the opinion of a critic who, you know, say it's somebody writing about, you know, 1950s Italian, you know, neorealism. I would rather somebody who read a critic who is familiar with that genre of cinema, who knows where it sprang from, the kind of the political and social context which informed it. I'd rather read a review of some, you know, by somebody like that, than somebody who has never watched a film like that and who's just kind of like, oh, what's this, and just, you know, giving some subjective thoughts about it.
But Suicide Squad got like a bad review right there. Ben-Hur got a bad review. See, these movies
what
are getting bad
what
reviews.
What do you mean, though, by bad review? Because, like, for instance, Suicide Squad, and I'm speaking anecdotally here.
I'm just going through, like, Rotten Tomatoes right now.
That is such a problematic site. Like, I don't really, you know, the reviews I saw from professional critics, if you want to call that, in who are writing for like established media sites, but basically giving that film kind of like 2 or 3 stars out of 5, which, you know, that to me is not a bad review. That's
you're right.
That's an average film.
aggregators are not necessarily the best arbiter of what makes a film good or bad, because I've been responsible for putting Rotten Tomatoes scores into Rotten Tomatoes when I was an intern for another site. And sometimes, you know, you look at something like a C review, they give it, you know, a C+. Well, what does that necessarily mean? It's neither good or bad. So I would actually have to read the review and use my judgment as to whether they were saying it was good or bad, even though they said, you know, hey, there's a lot of merits, but overall. So aggregators necessarily aren't the best thing. I think we rely on them a bit too frequently, because you can read, you know, a bunch of reviews from those same aggregators, and those negative reviews can still say, you know, fans of the film are going to like, fans of this will like that, or something else.
So you're saying that Rotten Tomatoes is not the best site to get, critical evaluation.
Unless you're going to read the actual reviews, no. If you're going on and just looking at the tomato rating, you're not really understanding, you know, it's literally just an algorithm. So okay. You're literally coming out with what they're spitting out. Unless, if someone actually goes and reads every review there, the ones from the, you know, writers that they like, then yeah, Rotten Tomatoes can be a good indicator. But most people don't do that. They literally just look at the number.
Okay. All right. Fair enough there. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that I feel, as being both a fan and a critic, is difficult to decipher, actually, because, you know, I write reviews and do these shows right here, and I don't think I have any sort of professional opinion. I've never worked on films, but I try to watch as many of them as I can, and I think we can all form our own opinions right there. I just worry about mainly if we just are not connected with the average viewer as a critic is. And Will has made some points there too about, you know, how a critic knows more things about films. You know, he or she studies a particular genre, and that's the type of reviews that you want to read in there. I'm going back more towards like the whole thing that I guess DC fans wanted to shut down Rotten Tomatoes for the Suicide Squad getting bad reviews and everything, and I don't think the movie has been kind of like, I wouldn't say it's been dropping in the box office. It dropped a little bit, though. But I remember back in the past or two where, like, critics, their reviews of a movie could have, like, made or break box office. And that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. Do you think that critics are still important in bringing up box office or having movies fail box office? Do you agree with that?
If critics weren't important, we wouldn't be invited to movies. We wouldn't get screeners come the year's end. There wouldn't be award shows for each individual, or awards at least, for each individual critics group. So, and the Hollywood Foreign Press for the Golden Globes is critics, made up at least a portion of them. So, yeah, critics are important. The problem lies in the audience in general relying on critics when it's convenient, whether they say it quote unquote sunk or elevated a movie. And what people fail to realize with something like Suicide Squad, it's making a lot of money. People still went out to see it. So, and critics who reviewed it knew it's a DC movie. It's a big summer blockbuster in a summer that's been very soft. It was still going to make money. And at that point, people say, oh, well, see, this proves critics aren't important. No, this proves that the audience, when you guys bitch about the lack of good movies or the lack of original content, it's BS, because you'll go see subpar films. So I think it's funny that we use criticism to elevate or sink when it's stuff that's already low-hanging fruit. Critics did not sink Ben-Hur. Ben-Hur is an unnecessary remake that was not good. So I love that movies that we already knew from the get-go were not going to be good. Oh, the critics are what damned it. No, the lack of audience is going to see it is what damned it. Hollywood is a numbers game. It's a money game. So critics, as much as we love to toot our own horn, we are important when it comes to helping Hollywood determine what's worth their time. not always the masses. The masses are what determines to Hollywood what gets made. It's all a dialectic. Everybody needs to exist in order for the Hollywood machine to keep going.
Okay. But Will's laughing about that. You.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, it is just, you know, people, I talk to people or friends of mine, and, you know, they bemoan, oh, like, you know, the lack of original ideas in, like, sort of Hollywood or whatever. And I you know, and they go, oh, you know, it's just Hollywood is a money-making machine. It exists to make money. They don't, if they make art along the way, then
that's a bonus.
That's a bonus. They exist to make money. And, you know, if rebooting Spider-Man for the fourth or fifth time will make them more money, they will do that. You know, it just everything, all other kind of considerations. If making subpar films makes money, they will do that. You know,
yeah.
it's not any more complicated than that. And yeah, they're not trying to make, you know, great films or the best films. They're just trying to make profitable films.
The movie that I didn't think was going to be profitable, especially where I work at a theater, and one of the most popular movies we had there for kids' films, I had more people going to see Nine Lives than Kubo in one weekend there, like on the screen right there. But that's just for our theater. It's a very small theater. But then I checked with other theaters around the area, the AMC theaters, and it was the same thing too. But look at the box office there. You know, Kubo is doing much better. So is Pete's Dragon, which I just found personally that's just kind of a weird thing, especially in the area I live in here, because I live in like a Midwestern town. And I just find that odd that a movie that did like really bad, people that went in to see that movie came out saying that, oh, that was really good. Same thing with that, what's that movie with Emma Watson? Not Emma Watson, fuck, Emma Roberts.
Oh, Nerve.
Nerve, yeah. Another very popular movie at my theater, but apparently not so popular everywhere else. It's just it's hard to determine here what's going to become, you know, a big movie or not a big movie.
Not necessarily. If you look at the signs, I mean, for me, somebody who looks at trends and what's in and out in terms of cinema, I mean, Nine Lives was another one that kind of latched onto the post Suicide Squad backlash and tried to say, oh, it's because critics don't understand. No, critics understand that movie's garbage. It's Kevin Spacey playing a talking cat. And we responded as such. If anybody needs to be attacked, it's the parents of America who want to take their children to go see a shitty film like that to keep them quiet for 90 minutes. It's why movies like Alvin and the Chipmunks are making money. It's why animated films, especially like that, are literally pigs in shit being made, because they make money, because people will go see them. Kubo had a soft start because I think the marketing has not necessarily been good for it. There were questions about whether it was called Kubo or Kubo and the Two Strings. There was that slight backlash about the whitewashing of the Asian setting, but it's still making money. That's both criticism and word of mouth. People are telling other people, hey, this movie's good, and you have a nice soft opening. The problem lies with the fact that Hollywood now lives or dies on opening weekend. And if you don't open big, they don't consider it a success. You can be a small movie like Kubo or Hell or High Water and make a decent amount of money, make back your budget. But if you're not busting out of the gate with, you know, $90 million opening weekend, three times your investment, because the way Hollywood budgeting breaks down, you have your initial budget to make it, and then you have two times that to promote. So if you don't make, you know, say your movie's $10 million, your advertising's $20 million, if you don't clear $50 million, then you're considered subpar. So the way those things work out, it's just most 90% of movies are set up to fail. And it has nothing to do with criticism. It has everything to do with marketing, audience response, and how Hollywood, you know, crunches the numbers.
What I don't understand with that, you know, way of looking at the kind of the financial success of movies is that it kind of ignores like the long tail, in the fact that the film will then have DVD sales, there'll be sales onto sort of TV and all of these types of screenings. So, you know, these are cultural products which will exist for well, you know, for, you know, eternity now, I guess, with the fact that we, you know, don't really have to sort of worry about film perishing in the same way that we have in years past. So I don't quite understand. You know, I completely recognise the picture you're painting, Kristen, but what I don't quite understand is why Hollywood hasn't shifted its thinking to actually think, you know what, if this film makes its budget back just on, like, domestic, you know, on its domestic cinematic release, you know, we'll pick up more money from, you know, box office sales, then there'll be the DVD, then there'll be the sort of, you know, the TV syndication broadcast rights, etc. And, you know, it will, you know, it will make a profit ultimately in the long term. I don't know if you've got any insight onto why they're sort of so fixated on that sort of quick turnaround on profit.
Well, what's interesting is that we don't have the room anymore in Hollywood for the film that just kind of settles. You know, I think one of the most popular films that never reached number one was My Big Fat Greek Wedding, and that stuck around for months at, you know, 2 and 3, and it had a really nice long shelf life, but it never topped the box office. We don't plan for that anymore. Everything either rises right away or sinks like a stone. We don't have the film that just has a nice, comfortable lead for a couple of weeks and makes back its money. But now Hollywood doesn't even think of U.S. box office. It's international dollars, specifically the Asian markets. It's why something like Warcraft can have a $200, you know, million-dollar budget and make nothing here. But it's still considered a massive success because it made all that money in China. And we'll probably get another one, even though American audiences don't want it. It's still it's why Tom Cruise keeps making Mission Impossible movies, because he gets the tax breaks from the foreign countries. And those movies do boffo box office in China and Japan. And that's what we essentially now the box office, we keep seeing more generic movies that have this ability to transcend language barrier. You know, it's why smaller movies, you know, they are looking now at what's going to do well internationally. You know, it's why we don't make movies unless it's like a North Korean, you know, villain. We don't have, you know, stereotypical Asian villains anymore because we don't want to offend all the people that go pay to see those movies. So now it's we do look at the international. But you're right. I mean, we don't have movies that we say, okay, well, you know, it did decently here. It stuck around a couple of weeks. It'll probably break even. You know, we don't want break even. We want go big or go home.
That makes sense, too. That's probably why they keep making the Ice Age movies, because yeah. I think those do very well in Russia, and they're always the same type of story. No, that's a good point you bring up there too, Kristen, about the foreign film market and how that we are basically making movies, very simple plots, very simple characters, very one-note characters. If you want to make movies for a foreign film market that doesn't rely too much on dialogue or character exposition or anything like that, you want someone that's going to be kind of like bright and colorful, someone that doesn't need a lot of subtitles. Because if it's less subtitles you have for an audience here, the better. That's probably why something like Mechanic Resurrection has been doing pretty well despite the bad reviews, because it's just a simple action movie. Don't need more than that. But I'm excited to see that movies like Kubo and the Two Strings or Pete's Dragon or even like War Dogs, which actually deals with a little bit more subject matter that foreign film markets are not used to, getting a little bit bigger. Actually, I'm really kind of surprised by that. I was surprised that even though Don't Breathe is the most recent horror film right now, I didn't think that would take up the top spot this weekend. I didn't. I thought it'd be in the top five, but I was very surprised by that. So,
I'm surprised that exists in 2016.
Yeah.
But, surprised, you know, that's a movie that we've made.
You know, there's like, what's it now? Like, sometimes independent films get released that get a good, I guess, buzz from audiences, but they don't get released wide. There was a movie called My Name is Doris with Sally Field that, you know, started off, at least where I live, started off as the independent theaters, and it got a good word of mouth. And so certain theaters, like big chain theaters, started to get it. And it started to go very well there, but it never went wide. And I just want your kind of opinions about that. Movies that kind of start off small and start to get big, but they never go wide. why would that be? Like the South Side with you, Florence Foster Jenkins is a movie that is doing very well with critics, but we're probably not going to get it in our theaters.
Well, it's all at that point. It's up to the theater itself to. I mean, the theater is deciding what's going
I'm talking
to.
About, like, big chains here too, like big chains that you know are just not playing it in certain markets here too. And I live in an area too where it's like a pretty good. It would be perfect for that type of theater too, because they're all like middle aged, all kind of like rich, ritzy people there. It's a very kind of like a established place there. I'm just kind of curious about. Why, or your opinion about why different theater chains refuse to take on different movies?
Well, it's a combination of things. The theater has to be willing to play it. It's why my theater, you know, they know that they have a very healthy, they have to have a very healthy, because it would only, that's the only explanation why, we have a very healthy Bollywood market. And I live in Sacramento, so it's not necessarily a huge, and I live in a very small town in Sacramento. And we get 3 and 4 Bollywood films at our local Cinemark on the weekend. I don't know why, but those there must be a healthy market or else Cinemark would not take those films. Okay. So there's that. But at the same time, the studio is putting money forward. And if the movie's not going to bust out of the gate, they're not going to promote it any further. So a great example is something like Hands of Stone that came out this weekend in about 800 theaters. And it's not probably going to go any wider than that those 800 theaters, because the money's just not there. There's no point to release it out to the more expansive markets and even go, you know, rural, because there's just no return on investment. It's a far cry. I mean, it's a lot easier now to see movies in limited release than it was 20, 30 years ago, where a movie would open in like one theater in LA and you wouldn't get it in your local theater until about 2-3 months out. Which is how they did it in the, you know, 60s and 70s. I mean, we didn't get movies that were open wide release until, like, Jaws. So it shows you how little time has been developed there on the wide release. But something like Florence Foster Jenkins, it's an awards contender. It's got good word of mouth. People love Meryl. So that's definitely going to expand. But you're going to, you know, the smaller movies that they know inherently are going to be found on, like, video on demand or DVD, there's no point in, you know, wasting the money to send them out into the other theaters if they know that the return on investment is going to be minimal.
And I think that's something that is, it's a bit depressing, really. It's definitely a picture that I recognize. I mean, I grew up in a I'm from England, and I grew up in a, you know, probably a town which would describe itself as probably the most cosmopolitan town in the country. And yet, you know, I sort of look at what is on in the kind of the big multiplex cinemas there. It is just the kind of the Ice Age sequels, the kind of the animated things for kids. Then it is your Suicide Squads, your Batman versus Superman's, the kind of big budget movies. There is absolutely like nothing sort of in between that. I think, you know, that you had to have gone inside of one to see something like The Big Short, which I wouldn't even say is a particularly intelligent film or anything. What was that George Clooney film that came out a little bit earlier?
Money Monster or Hail Caesar?
Yeah, Money Monster. And, you know, you couldn't... Those films were shown for like 3 days in those cinemas and then disappeared. There's just, you know, and they're not even, you know, they've got big name actors in, or they've got kind of, you know, Oscar buzz around them. They just came and went in an absolute eye blink. And, you know, it is as we were sort of talking about, they just want the chains. They know what's going to bring in the money. And you can kind of sit here and blame the studios. You can sit here and blame the cinema chains. But, you know, I think audiences, you know, have to kind of look to themselves, because exactly that same point that you were making, I where I live in London, my local cinema regularly also shows Bollywood movies. So, you know, if you go and vote with your backside and put your bum on a seat, those theatre chains will show films, you know, show you whatever you want, whether there's a marketing push behind it or not. You know, there's no marketing push behind those Bollywood films, but they're still sticking them on. They're obviously getting people through the door to watch them, so they're going to keep on doing it. So, you know, if you're not getting the kind of the films that you want in your local cinema, I think audiences have to look at sort of where they're spending their money.
Exactly. Yeah. It's always surprising to me that they keep, you know, my theater does a classic series that isn't the best, you know, visited, but TCM and Fathom are putting a lot of money behind them, so they screen it, which always makes me happy. But I mean, come award season, if not for some of the screeners I get and award nominations, I probably would miss out on quite, you know, at least half of the independent films that come out. And that's because a lot of them just decide, hey, we're hoping for the video on demand market. You know, we're hoping for something where people are actually going to be interested in seeing things. And I mean, it's understandable in some of the theater situations because there's so much content coming in because you're getting 3 and 4 movies at a time, and the theaters almost benefit from carrying movies as long as they can, because if nobody knows this, it's the reason why your concessions are $5 and $6, because that's where the theater itself actually makes the money. Because opening weekend, a film split, it's 90-10. So 90% of the proceeds of a movie opening weekend go back to the studio. 10% stays with the theater. The longer the movie plays in your local cinema, the better the split gets for the theater. So second week is 80-20, you know, third week is 70-30. And eventually, by like the ninth week, the theater is actually taking in 100% of the profits. And unless they know that movie is going to end up making them money in the long term, they're not going to hold it.
Yeah, and I you know, I don't know enough about economics, but I've read how that, you know, economic system works for the cinema chains. And it seems to me to be slightly self-defeating. It just seems that the studios are just screwing over the theatre chains in a very short-sighted way. Whereas if they sort of relaxed their economic model a bit, they might actually make some more money, but they just seem to
it explains a lot of why theaters are so resistant to new platforms. You know, in the 90s, Disney actually wanted to make movies day and date. You could see the movie in a theater if you wanted, or you could just go and buy the DVD. They actually wanted to do that, and the theater said no. If you do that, then we're going to boycott your films, because they lose that ability to hold the money, to hold the movie and make money. And so Disney actually came out and said, okay, well, what if we did it so that you could buy a ticket, you go see the movie in the theater, you come out and you show your ticket stub, and for like an extra $10, you could buy the movie on DVD right there. And the theater said no. It's why when Tower Heist, which is a bad example of a movie, but they wanted to release it to VOD. And just say for, you know, $20, you can have it opening weekend. And the theater said, again, no, we're not going to do that. Because the theater's in the one between a rock and a hard place. Because they need to have some ability to make money. But the economic model that Hollywood is using doesn't help them unless the movie is a hit that they can hold for several weeks, so that the theater actually gets to keep some of it.
And the other knock-on effect of that is the sort of continual decline in cinema audiences. And, you know, I don't know what cinema going is like in the States, but certainly in the UK, it just gets more and more expensive. And, you know, it pushes people into just sort of staying at home and watching stuff on, you know, streaming services. Whereas, you know, I'd go and see a pretty average film if it was cheaper, because, you know, I like going to cinema, I like watching films. So, you know, if I was paying less money, I'd take more risks in the films that I go to see. But, you know, at the kind of cost that I'm paying at the moment in the UK, I kind of want like a sure thing before I decide to part with my sort of hard-earned money.
Yeah, you know, honestly, I bought you guys on this story here right now because you guys are both professionals and whatnot, and you would give a little more insight into this, especially you, Kristen, because you've been contributing to many different sites and you rate for award circuit and everything. You kind of know, you have a little more insight into the whole critical game than most of us. And I'm not trying to disparage, you know, Will or myself at all. We're both critics right there, but we're just not professionally like you, Kristen.
I feel very insulted, Vern, frankly.
No, don't be insulted. You're a very important podcast.
Very insulted.
Don't be insulted, all right? But one thing, I want to have a little fun on this show right now. Can you, each of us, and I know I'm trying to put you on the spot, but can each of us say a movie that we like, but know is probably bad, but we still enjoy it, we'll still give it a good review, no matter what critics or audiences have said about it?
Do you have all day? Because I'm pretty sure half the movies I watch are not good, but I've watched them anyway.
Okay. Well, let's do this right now. I need to take a quick break and probably play some ad spots of other wonderful LAMB Podcast Network shows, and we'll be right back with that, okay?
Hey guys, this is JD from the In Session Film Podcast. Every week on our show, you can join my co-host Brendan and I as we review the latest films that's out in theaters. It also inspires us to discuss a top three list of some sort, and we have a lot of other fun movie discussions as well. It's always a blast. And we also have a show on Fridays called our Extra Film Podcast. This is a show that gives us the space to talk about the latest indies and art films and other classics that we normally just don't get to talk about on our main show. You can find our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, SoundCloud, TuneIn Radio, Player FM, and more. In fact, you can just see everything about us, including our social medias, at InSessionFilm.com. So join us every week. We'd absolutely love to have you.
So this thing we want to do, what exactly is it?
I think it's a podcast.
I think he just made that word up.
Anyway, what would it be about?
It can be about those things we see in the things, you know, with the pictures and the acting, and sometimes Ryan Gosling.
Oh, you mean films?
Yeah, those. We can talk about those.
And Ryan Gosling.
And what would we call it?
Women who speak weirdly.
Ladies? Young ladies? All the single ladies.
Oh, wait, I know. Chicks with accents.
Yeah, and we could use that song from the Beatles and that movie, Across the Universe.
Cool.
Yeah.
Listen to the Across the Universe podcast,
brought to you by the Chicks with Accents.
Available just about everywhere.
And we are back. Thank you, everyone, for joining us on this episode of The Film Pasture, talking about film criticism and audiences and all about theaters, management, trying to choose the right movies there or not. Before the break, we had a little conversation here. And one thing I wanted to mention, and we may have cut off at that same time, is that where I live and work, they always have four or five theaters playing the same movie. There's an IMAX showing, there's a 3D showing, and then a regular showing. And for the big movies that come out, especially for big blockbuster movies and animated movies, sometimes when you go to see a movie, that's all you see. Like for my theater, we had Suicide Squad playing in four different theaters. We had Pete's Dragon playing in another three theaters. Same thing goes with that Nine Lives movie, Kubo and the Two Strings. And down the line, there's maybe two or three other movies that are just so small they don't get played until later on. So when you're as a theater goer and as a fan, you go to see a movie and some of that's just all you see, and the lack of choices there, you aren't real, that will just bring you to stay at home. And I don't know if there's anything to do to change it, but I think Will's right, people just gotta pay with their dollars. I don't know if it's a marketing thing, because certain movies, they don't get marketed as often on regular channels than other movies do. And plus, it depends on too what people are watching. Like, I know Comedy Central, they'll play trailers that other stations won't play. So that whole thing too, I don't know. Just giving my opinion on the whole thing there. But what I would have you on here for is we're going to have a little fun right now and have us each kind of talk about a movie that we like, we enjoy it, but audiences and critics don't like it as well. Kristen, I'll start with you on that one.
Oh, there's so many movies I could list. Half of what I watch is probably subpar. Because, yeah, if everybody knows of my obsessive love with, like, half the men of Hollywood, then y'all know I've watched a lot of crappy movies. And I probably will defend most of them. But the one I always throw out is Showgirls. I love Showgirls. It's a bad movie, but it's fun. And there's actually been a lot of criticism of it as a feminist text, which I don't know if I necessarily buy, but I think it's great. And I also throw out Xanadu. Xanadu's another one I throw out. I am a big fan of musicals. And you know what? It doesn't make any sense. And Olivia Newton-John is a Greek goddess with an Australian accent, but I love it so much.
Girls on Roller Skates. That's got me. Girls on Roller Skates plus it got the orchestra. Who's that band here? Is it Olivia Newton-John and fuck?
Yep.
Who's that?
And Gene Kelly's in there.
Yeah. It's got animation from John Bluth.
Yes, it does. It does. It's so fun. I have it on Blu-ray, and I love that movie so much.
Oh, gosh. I haven't seen the movie in, like, ages, and I don't remember too much about the movie, just mainly the soundtrack. And I thought the soundtrack – I still think the soundtrack is pretty cool, actually.
The soundtrack especially is so fun.
The only thing I remember most about that movie is the opening sequence where all the muses are coming out, and they all have roller skates on. They're all dancing to that song in the beginning.
I could probably say there's a shared universe between that and Showgirls because they both involve dance and statuesque blondes with questionable acting.
Ah, very well. What about you, Will?
Well, there's quite a few I could pick, but I'm gonna plump for Gothica, which got pretty critically panned when it came out, but.
Is that the movie with Robert Downey Jr. and Halle Berry?
Yeah, so it's got Halle Berry, Robert Downey Jr., it's got Penelope Cruz in, and Charles S. Dutton as well, so it's got a really great cast. It's really super stylized in terms of its direction, like the lighting is all very, it's all, they spent a lot of time on kind of like controlling the kind of, I don't know, the colors and the tint, and it's all sort of dark and gloomy. It's all very over stylized, and the whole film has this sort of like heightened sort of ghost story type of atmosphere to it. And, you know, it is, you know, it's just a really enjoyable film. I'm not, you know, going to try and pretend that it's great art. But, you know, it's a really enjoyable film with a good cast and I think quite well directed. It's certainly, you know, a lot of attention has been paid on the set design and on the cinematography. I think it's a really good, enjoyable film. And I think it's, you know, there are some slight absurdities to the plot. I won't pretend that. But, you know, it is a really enjoyable film. I don't quite understand why people have been so sniffy about it.
I remember going to see that in theaters, but much like my recent discussion yesterday about the films of McGee, I remember nothing about going to see Gothica. That's one of many films that I can say, I know I saw that in a theater, but nothing sticks with me.
Yeah, the only thing that only thing I know is that it was directed by Matthew Cassavetes, who did Lehane. And if you don't know the guy, he's the guy in The Fifth Element who tries to shoot Bruce Willis and he's got the thing on his head. Yeah, that guy. I only saw the movie once. I can't say anything about it, but I didn't hate it either. It's something I gotta watch again. I think I get this movie and The Cell confused, and I don't know why. They're both very different movies, but they have the same type of look, at least in my opinion.
Well, I think some of the reason that this film took such a sort of critical pounding was that I think it came out right after Halle Berry won her Oscar, and so I think that there was a sort of sense of that she should have moved above doing things like this. And, you know, I think that factored into some of its critical reception. But as I say, if you sort of put all of that aside and just judge this film on its merits and you just want to see a sort of like entertaining sort of, you know, old dark house type movie, then, you know, Gothica is a very entertaining watch.
Very good. And let you know, too, folks, that Gothica scored like 14% on Rotten Tomatoes, while Xanadu scored 36% on Rotten Tomatoes. And it's a funny thing too, because Xanadu has become a little bit more of a cult classic because that one has, I guess, a new musical made by it, though. I think it was a new musical.
Yeah, they did just... they did a Broadway show.
Yeah.
Which is very funny, and it makes fun. I probably could have picked worse movies that have no redeeming value, but I wanted to save some of my credibility.
Okay, fair enough here. Well, one movie for me that I will still defend to this day, and I think it's a lot of fun, and I don't care if people like it or not. I've got two here, and I was trying to go back between one or the other. I'm going to choose Howard the Duck as mine. I also was going to choose Cruel World, because I think it's a movie that, you know, a lot of people hate as well. But Howard the Duck for me, still a lot of fun. I watched it recently. It's one of those movies, too, that when it came out later on, I guess Lea Thompson disowned the movie. And now she put her likeness into a comic book of Howard the Duck, which is actually kind of cool. But I loved everything about this movie when I was a kid. Still think it's funny. I like the soundtrack for it, though. I had everything about this movie when it came out. And I watched it recently, and I think it's still a lot of fun. It's one of those PG-rated movies that will never happen today. And for that alone, I love it. Because there's no way in hell you can have a movie about a duck from outer space where it shows duck tits and a girl trying to seduce a duck, and it's got beer drinking, and there's a scene where Howard goes to a set shop or a set spa and works there, all confined within this PG-rated movie. It's just one of those capsules in times that will never happen again, and just for that reason alone, I love it.
It's also it's also the first Marvel sort of studio movie, I think.
Very good goal.
Who would have thought that they would have gone from Howard the Duck? Because I remember when Howard the Duck was released, very controversial film, because as you say, the content was deemed not appropriate for a PG film, PG kids film. Who would have thought that that film would have been the launch pad for possibly the most successful studio of recent times?
I know, and after seeing Howard the Duck at the end of Guardians of the Galaxy, I'm hoping they do another version of Howard the Duck. All right, I do, and I want it to be as vulgar as this one was, if not more so. All right, because Howard the Duck is definitely that type of character. Because in the comic books too, Howard and Beverly actually do end up like hooking up. All right. They do. They kind of like hinted at that in the movie right there, but yeah. Sorry, when I was like 12, 13 year old, yeah, seeing Lea Thompson in her panties, yeah, that's like going through puberty for me right there. Yeah.
I have never seen this movie, so.
It's too bad. It's not a Disney movie, too. I'm upset it's not a Disney movie because I can't suggest it for Walt sent me.
Ha! Yay!
But although, can it be now because basically Howard the Duck is part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and Marvel Cinematic Universe is part of Disney? Does that still work?
As Todd explained when he was talking about Star Wars, we couldn't do the original films because they weren't Disney at the time, so no.
No, shit! Damn it. But what if Disney buys the rights to the movie and then re-releases it under their label?
I still don't think it counts.
Doesn't it? Ah, shoot, okay. All right, fair enough. But I think that's going to kind of wrap things up. Like I said before, I really want to kind of keep this a short episode. But before we close out the show, I want to give some updates here. Will, what's going on with this Explodin' Helicopter? Anything going on with you guys?
Yeah, I just posted a new episode of the Explodin' Helicopter podcast. So we are looking at Steven Seagal's ecological action movie On Deadly Ground in our latest episode. Very, very strange film. It goes off in some very strange directions, and it's the only film Steven Seagal has ever been allowed to direct. And after you watch this film, it's completely understandable why a studio never let him direct another film. Also, on our website, we've just posted a new review of the 70s disaster classic, The Towering Inferno. So, yeah, head over to the website or check out the podcast if you want to listen or read about those films.
Those are great. And that can always be found at explodinghelicopters.com.
ExplodingHelicopter.blogspot.com. Or if you can, and you can find the podcast on iTunes or whatever your kind of preferred podcast player is.
Well, okay. Speaking about ecological dramas and thrillers, there's one movie that I would love for you to review on your show, and that is Forest Warrior.
Forest Warrior.
Forest Warrior. Chuck Norris plays an Indian or somewhat Indian descent who gets killed and is able to come back and become different creatures of nature. So he can become a bear, or he can become a hawk.
Chuck Norris made this film.
Yes, Chuck Norris, Forest Warrior.
Wow. And does it have an explaining helicopter in?
It's got explosions in there though, but I don't know if there are helicopter explosions there. All right, I might have looked it up for you.
Are you following the site, Vern? Because it's a pretty fundamental requirement that any film I review has an explaining helicopter in.
I'm pretty sure it does. It's some sort of plane. I wasn't quite sure if it was a helicopter or not. And when I saw it, I was been drinking. I looked up. I saw something in the sky exploded. I'm pretty sure it was a helicopter. I could have been wrong. It could have been a fucking bird. All right?
You know what? I'm going to watch this film. It sounds too bonkers. So whether it's got an exploding helicopter in or not, I'm going to watch it. If it's got one in, I'll review it on the site and on the podcast. I will promise you. Okay. I'll promise you that, Vern.
It is a bad movie. It's something you probably find most likely on The Lair of the Unwanted there. But yes, just Chuck Norris just being a shape-shifting animal changer there. Got a bunch of really bad kids who kind of remind me of I would say now. They remind me of the kids in the movie, I guess, any type of kids you have. I was going to say the kids in the movie It, but no, it's basically just really bad kids that shouldn't have anything to do with the environment, and yet they do. I don't know. Kristen.
Yes.
What's going on with you and the – tell me more about that new podcast show you started up there, which I'm sorry to say I don't remember the name of it. I feel bad because you're my co-host.
Yeah, I started a podcast about a month or so ago called Ticklish Business. It's a classic film podcast discussing pre-1970s movies. So there's only four episodes right now, four or five. So there's been some interviews with some authors, some of my TCM classic film footage up there, a discussion about Planet of the Apes, and if all goes right this time, we're doing a discussion on Ben-Hur, which we had actually recorded 2 weeks ago, but my recorder deleted it. We're actually trying take two. We're going to be talking the 1959 versus the 2016 version of Ben-Hur, actually.
Well, very good.
That should be fun. That's at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com.
Why the name Ticklish Business? I may have asked you this before, but it sounds like a fetish site.
It's actually part of a quote from Jane Russell in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. And if you listen to the podcast, I include the audio right in the beginning so that people will know where it came from.
Okay, fair enough there. All right, so check that out. Ticklishbusiness.podbean.com?
Yes.
All right, well, very good. And as always, you can listen to our older episodes by searching for Film Pastor through Podomatic. Go to largeassmovieblogs.com, and we'll post this episode on there as well. I mentioned through Twitter and Facebook that it's best if you try and download our early episodes now, because they are going to be deleted soon. I don't keep any backup of these episodes, so if you want them, download them through Podomatic now, and if not, then you're just shit out of luck, because I need to make space, and I'm not paying for more space to post the shows on. All right, so that's it for now. Please follow us on Twitter at Film Pasture. Check us out on Facebook as well. I am the Vern. Follow me at Video Vanguard. That's it. I think that's all we have to say. Kristen, where can they find you on Twitter?
I am at @journeys_film.
All right. And Will, where can they find you on Twitter?
At Chopper Fireball.
Chopper Fireball. Check that out there. Also, check out their Facebook pages, too. I think for you, Will, just if they search Exploded Helicopters, that should pull you up.
It certainly should.
Okay. Same thing with Kristen Froy. Say they're just should they look up Kristen Lopez or just Journeys in Classic Film to find you?
Journeys in Classic Film does have a Facebook page. I'm also at facebook.com/klopez1.
Okay. All right. Well, again, thank you, everyone. Like I said before, kind of a short episode, but we'll be back with another discussion later on. I'm not quite sure what that's going to be, but I'll talk to people about that. But I'm going to go eat some breakfast and drink some coffee because I'm still a little drunk right now. But I will talk to you all soon.
Cheers, man.
Cheers, guys. Thank you, guys.
All right. Bye.